From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, those open lines followed by a special tribute to a departed Coast to Coast guest. Here's what's happening. Russian forces in Ukraine sparked worldwide alarm as they seized Europe's biggest nuclear power plant, and Moscow blocked Facebook and some other foreign media websites as it passed a fake news law amid mounting censure from global companies. The biggest attack on a European state since World War II has created more than 1 million refugees, a barrage of sanctions, and exodus of firms from Russia in fears of a global economic hit and wider conflict in the West unthought of for decades. Fighting raging in the Ukraine as Russian troops besieged and bombarded cities in the second week of an invasion that has isolated Moscow. We'll keep our eyes on that. Russian President Vladimir Putin signed into law Friday legislation that would punish journalists with prison time for publishing news that contradicts official statements about Moscow's war in Ukraine. Under the new law, reporters face up to 15 years in prison if they report what authorities deem as false reports about the military. The legislation was passed by both chambers of the Russian parliament. My gosh. Abbott Nutrition's baby formula recall has now been expanded to include one lot of Similac PM. It's called 6040. The Food and Drug Administration said in an update that health officials were investigating an additional illness of Coronabacter, which is a bacteria germ that exposed to powdered infant formula produced at the company's Sturgis, Michigan facility. A baby died of that infection. Food safety coach Jeff Nelken with us. My gosh, Jeff, how serious can this get?
Well, this is a serious bug, and it's generally found, you know, in the powdered formula, not the liquid formula. And if we have anybody that the kids might, preemie babies are susceptible, and some older adults, you know, that may have had cuts could possibly, you know, it could be introduced that way. But keep in mind that if you do have babies that have any irritability, jaundice, or grunting while breathing, they certainly should contact their personal physicians. But those people that may have Similac and other similar products, if they're not sure about the, code on it, there's SimilacRecall.com that you can contact, and then there's also Abbott Laboratories that you can call 1-800-986-8540 to verify if you might have that product, you know, on your shelf at home.
Jeff, when a car is recalled, they know who bought the car, so they send you a notice to your house. With food and beverages and things like Similac today, they don't know who bought these things, do they?
You're right. It's one of those areas that needs to be reinforced, and we need some better strategies, because there are very few states even that require this particular bacteria, when it's discovered, to be reported. So most people aren't even, you know, reporting this. So it's one of the areas that we need to do a better job at.
Okay, thanks. Jeff Nelken, foodsafetycoach.com. That rogue rocket we've been talking about ended its seven-year space odyssey, finally slamming into the backside of the moon. The event took place at 7:25 a.m. Eastern Time today on the lunar far side. Experts say that it probably came from a Chinese rocket. What else is going on in the skies? It's time for Kevin Randall, the retired Army Lieutenant Colonel. Hello, sir. What do we have?
Hey, good evening, George. How you doing?
Okay.
Well, let's take a quick trip back to 1947.
All right, Roswell time.
Absolutely. Something strange falls northwest of Roswell, and the Air Force eventually identifies it as a balloon array from Project Mogul. Here's the problem. Sheridan Cavett told Air Force investigators when he first saw the debris scattered in the field, he knew it was a balloon. But that's not the first time he saw the debris. Mac Brazel, who originally found it, took samples into Roswell to show to the sheriff. We have testimony from two people, firsthand testimony, who were there, that Brazel had that debris. Both the sheriff's daughter, Phyllis McGuire, said that, and Colonel Thomas DeBose said that debris was sent from Roswell to Fort Worth and then on to Washington, D.C. That was 2 days before Marcel showed up after visiting the field. But if the debris was nothing more than a balloon, easily recognized according to Cabot, then why did Marcel have to travel to the field? The point here is that the Mogul explanation fails because there is no reason for Marcel to have made that investigation after having seen samples in the sheriff's office. And I've got it all laid out in depth on my blog. So let's now move to 2022.
Let's do it.
I normally avoid sightings of glowing orbs, but this is an interesting one. According to William Puckett at his website, on February 26th, a couple on a cruise ship near Long Beach, California, said that they had awakened early in the morning when it got up and then pulled back the stateroom curtain. They saw two glowing orbs pacing the ship. Both of them said they were looking at the orbs about 100 yards away, moving toward the bow. The orbs were hazy and, in the witness's word, swirly. When his first thought was that there was some sort of reflection from the ship's lights, the witness said that one of the lights broke away from the other at a high rate of speed, then stopped and returned to its original position. It then moved over the top of the other orb, flew beneath it, and finally seemed to merge with it, and they finally disappeared at high speed. Of course, this isn't a particularly exciting UFO encounter. However, before the witnesses returned to bed, they saw another light, this one underwater, approaching from the stern. It reached a point at about midship and then remained in that position in relation to the ship for a short time. The light broke away, making a violent turn to the right, returned to its original position for about 10 seconds, and then made another violent turn and finally disappeared, moving toward the stern. According to the witness, it was difficult to tell its depth or size, but it was glowing brightly. Like the orbs, he said it was moving rapidly, like nothing he'd ever seen. And finally, a short one from February 11th of this year. The witness reported that while driving towards the Hoover Dam Lodge in Boulder City, Nevada, he saw two very bright, very large white lights hovering fairly low over Lake Mead. There was a wide gap between them. One of the lights remained in place while hovering, while the other one suddenly took off upwards at an angle and disappeared from sight within a second or two. When he pulled into the parking lot of the lodge, he could no longer see the remaining light, as it was now hidden behind a hill. And that's what we have for tonight, George.
All right, my friend, we'll talk to you next week. Retired Army Lieutenant Colonel Kevin Randall with his UFO reports. Why does it seem that during times of distress and upheaval, is there an increase in popularity of horror films? In a moment, Chris Alexander joins us next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie back with you, Chris Alexander back with us, Canadian-based, internationally published writer, editor, composer, filmmaker. He serves as the editor-in-chief of the legendary horror film magazine Fangoria and is the current editor and co-founder of Full Moon Entertainment's cult film magazine Delirium. As a filmmaker, he has directed such horror movies as Blood for Arena, Queen of Blood, Girl with a Straight Razor, Space Vampire, and Necropolis Legion. Welcome back, Chris. How are you?
I am excellent, George. It is, as always, a thrill to be here. As soon as I hear that Giorgio Moroder music pumping, I know I'm in a good place.
Here we are.
So thank you for having me.
Everything, you're out of Canada right now?
I'm out of Canada always, especially these last 2 years. I haven't been really able to go anywhere. So I am based in Toronto, Canada, and it's colder than a mother-in-law's kiss here at the moment. But, I'm happy to be here. Thankfully, due to technology, I can be on Mars as long as I have a phone or a Wi-Fi signal and communicate with everybody. So I'm in a good place.
Absolutely. You know, I had a little quick little story before you came on that times of distress and upheaval, a lot of people turn to horror films. Why is that?
Well, the reason we watch these kinds of often bleak and nihilistic entertainment, and sometimes not. Sometimes horror films are just, you know, kind of aesthetically beautiful, dark fantasies. But the reason we watch things that are otherworldly and bizarre is to, I think, anyways, for many reasons. But one is to obviously ease our tensions and anxieties surrounding our own mortality. I think, obviously, there's a biochemical reaction when we get close to the precipice of death. So we're getting off on the adrenaline rush of watching these safe, benign entertainments. But there's also the feeling that when we're surrounded by so many unknown elements and so much danger and death and upset, the moment we realize that our life is finite, I think we lose our innocence. And what a lot of these entertainments do is help us in a weird way feel the illusion of control over these things of which we have no control. So horror movies have been perpetually popular since the dawn of cinema. But the rule stands true today that every time the media throws at us ad nauseum all this tension and trauma that's happening all around us.
My God, yeah.
Instead of running from it, we gravitate towards it like moths to the flame. I mean, when this whole COVID thing hit on Netflix, the number one movie on Netflix for 6 months and the outset in 2020 was an older Steven Soderbergh eco-horror film called Contagion about a virus that's wiping out the world. That was the number one movie, and it was already 10 years old at that point. So people just, for some reason, for many reasons, just love this stuff in times of distress.
In the older days, Chris, we had Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, and people knew them. They knew them as Hollywood stars. Today, the films are more prevalent than the name of the actor or actress. Is that basically the case in horror films?
Well, I think that's the case with all films in many respects. So I think that what happened was, in the early days of cinema, what you saw is all that mattered. So the actor was king. The director was nobody. He was somebody that just kind of moved the actors around on set. Nobody really cared too much about the director. The cinematographer, and then you go down the line and all the craftsmen were invisible. Who cares? So yes, with horror, I mean, my goodness, the first horror film star, maybe the first bona fide star of all time, superstar, was maybe Lon Chaney. I mean, here was a guy who could do it all, who was an actor, a gifted mime, you know, coming out of vaudeville as he did. He was a proto special effects artist. He did all his own special effects. So he was kind of a brand in and of himself. And he was a director as well, a multi-hyphenate. But he was the first big star. You went to the movie because Lon Chaney was there. Now, we still do that now. Tom Cruise is Tom Cruise. Nobody cares who's directing a Tom Cruise movie by and large. This fan base flocks to his movies.
That's right.
But somewhere along the line, the director became king. And I think this has a complex history with the horror genre. But I would say it was probably, as we exit the 1960s and move into the 70s, suddenly the old guard started to wither, and the new guard, which was informed by French New Wave films and edgier stuff, it kind of rose to the surface. And then people started watching films based on the fact who was directing them. And that goes with horror. I mean, William Friedkin's The Exorcist, his name was about The Exorcist, you know. John Carpenter's Halloween, we refer to it as John Carpenter's Halloween. George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead, it is George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead. No one else's. So, the worm turned. And now we're kind of in this world now where there's so much media. People watch things for so many different reasons.
That's a good point.
A glut of celebrity when it comes to the horror genre now.
Was Alfred Hitchcock a top-notch guy in his day?
Well, I don't know, man. You know, Hitchcock is a funny one because he gets saddled with being this architect of horror. Now, was Hitchcock really a horror director? I mean, you look at his Master of Suspense was a name, a moniker that he kind of invented for himself. He was as much a P.T. Barnum as he was a great filmmaker, a great artist. But you look at his long list of credits, mysteries, thrillers, melodramas, comedies even. But it was in 1960 where Hitchcock, who had obviously toyed with the dark side of the mind in many of his films, very gauzy Hollywood stuff like Rear Window and North by Northwest. But by the time he got to 1960, he was doing a television show, and he had read Robert Bloch's Psycho, I think, on an airplane. And he was just floored by this nihilistic novel about, it was kind of loosely based on the story of Ed Gein, as you know.
Right.
And he acquired the rights very cheaply to the book, and no one wanted to back him. So his whole deal was he was putting his money where his mouth was, and he used a lot of the people that were working for cheap on his television show with a relatively low budget and no big stars, produce and direct Psycho. And Psycho, as you know, changed everything in 1960, not just by its structure, killing off its heroine in the first reel of the film, but also the level of violence you could show in a film was unprecedented. The way he shot it, the kink to it, with the almost transgender reveal of Norman Bates at the end, even something as seemingly innocuous as showing a toilet for the first time on screen, that was there. And it was all shot in shuddery, cheap-looking black and white, which unnerved people because people knew Hitchcock for these gauzy, super expensive color films. So that was, in many respects, a kind of new dawning of the horror genre, and that is all on rests on Hitchcock's shoulders.
His shower scene was probably one of the best film scenes ever done.
Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, and again, it's, look, when it comes to horror, people are so, you know, the misnomer is that horror films are just wall-to-wall splatter and gore and watching the human body get ripped apart. Well, there is that, for sure. But some of the best horror films, you know, really play with what you don't see, obviously. And that shower scene is a masterpiece of not just cuts on Janet Leigh's body, but it's cuts in the editing room. Because that knife, that's although right. There is some discrepancy whether or not you see the knife actually penetrate the flesh, there is a maybe one half a second shot where maybe you see something go in. Mostly that scene is a masterpiece of editing, and it took them, you know, a week to shoot that thing, just that shot, that scene. And also Bernard Herrmann's score with those violin stings screaming on the soundtrack every time that knife goes down. You don't see who the killer is. There's screams, there's the juxtaposition of the eyeball, the drain. I mean, it's a heavy-duty scene. Even today, you know, I teach horror film theory as well, and I remember showing my students that movie once. I picked up the DVD and I looked at the back and it said it was rated R, which kind of blew my mind. Here's a 50-year-old film. No, Psycho's not rated R. No, it's fairly innocuous. I popped it up and the students were sitting there in silence. And by the time the film ended, no one was laughing, not even nervously laughing. It's still a heavy duty movie, still really dark.
Chris Alexander with us. Chris, tell us right before the break here about this Fear on Film history of the horror movie, this 7-week course you're doing.
George, you've had me on the show a bunch of times, and you know it's fairly late. It's over 1:30 in the morning here in Toronto, and I am pumped and energized. I'm feeling flush and excited because I love this stuff. I eat, sleep, and breathe horror.
You do,
you know? And I have since I was three. You know, my first early memories are gravitating towards and also being afraid of, but trying to understand why I was afraid of this stuff. And so here I am in my late 40s, and nothing has changed. And I basically, you know, created a course called Fear on Film, which I taught prior many years ago. I've revived it out of Canada's Sheridan College, which is one of the number one film and technology courses in the world. But now being the necessity of being the mother of invention, having to go virtual, now I can offer this course virtually to anybody who has, again, Wi-Fi or Zoom can sign up for this course and sit with me for 7 weeks. And we can literally start at the beginning of cinema right up to today and understand the arc of cinema history, but seen through a very distorted, cool, abstract, blood-spattered lens. It's horror film history from stem to stern. It's a great entry point into the genre, but I have some deep cuts for the lifers as well. And it's also a great hangout for freaks and geeks like me who just want to sit around and talk about this weird, cool stuff.
How do people sign up for it?
You go to Sheridan College has been very friendly to me and made it really easy for you. And they've created a website, a URL, www.fearonfilm.ca. And that'll open up into another world for you where you can read about the course, see the course outline. Starts on March 8th at 7 o'clock, runs for 2 hours every week for 7 weeks. You can sign up and become part of the deal. And it's easy as 1, 2, 3, fearonfilm.ca.
Was there a film, Chris, during your early days that captured your imagination, your attention, that got you into this?
You know, I think no matter what guest you have on this show, no matter what subject they're riffing on, there's going to be some point in their life where they can easily trace it back to when that hit them, when that obsession started, when those interests developed. And that's true with me with horror films. When I was a kid, I was three. I remember this because I hadn't started kindergarten. My grandmother, my aunt, took me to the House of Frankenstein. It is a wax museum, one of the oldest in Canada, in Niagara Falls on the Canadian side. And, I was instantly intrigued. You know, I liked Halloween, as far as, dressing up for Halloween. So I liked the freak value of it. But I was scared. And as soon as they dragged me into that thing, I was terrified. And, of course, you couldn't come back out of the wax museum. You had to walk through it.
Ooh.
So I spent the entire time screaming with my hands over my eyes. And I remember my aunt laughing, but in a kind of like, oh, my God, what are we doing to this poor boy kind of laughing. And I think the real stinger was when you exited the wax museum, it threw you out into the gift shop. And I remember the Carpenters playing, and we've only just begun. I remember this clearly. And people looking at snow globes, and everyone was really quiet. Everything was friendly and shiny. And I couldn't reconcile the fact that I just walked into the seventh circle of hell.
I love it. Chris, hold on. We're going to take a break. We'll come back and pick it up. Then we'll talk about some of the history of horror films next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Chris Alexander, as we're talking about horror films. And Chris, right before the break, we were talking about what got you into this. I'll let you finish that part of the story up before we move ahead with more questions for you.
Yeah, George, I mean, I can trail. I need an editor, George. The editor needs an editor because I keep going. I can talk ad infinitum about this stuff. But
you love this
so
stuff.
I do. So it was the wax museum first, and I was terrified. I was trying to figure out why I was terrified. You know, I became obsessed, almost intellectually gravitating towards this before I even understood what that meant. But the first movie that really did me in, it was 1978's Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the remake of the Don Siegel movie by director Philip Kaufman, starring Donald Sutherland, Leonard Nimoy, and a very young Jeff Goldblum. I remember turning on the television. I was told by my parents I was not allowed to watch it. I was probably about five, six. And I turned on the station that I knew was playing it just in time to see Donald Sutherland caving in his clone's head with a garden hoe and all that blood and pus coming out of that. And on the soundtrack, there was a fetal monitor, I remember. It was just like getting hit upside the head with something. And that was it. There was no turning back. From that point on, it was all about Fangoria magazines, horror comic books, the rock band Kiss, whatever weird stuff I could get my hands on. That was my life.
When were the very first horror films created?
You know, here's something really interesting, because the very first film, period, or at least the prototype for a film, was kind of based around horror. Now, it wasn't a horror film, but it was kind of based. So cinema was invented on horror in many respects. There was a guy named Leland Stanford. He was the former governor of California. And on a gentleman's bet, he had a racehorse, and he was sitting at the track, and he was betting his buddies that the horse, when it jumped, all four legs would leave the track. And, of course, there was no way to use photography to kind of capture that kind of motion. So he hired a guy named Edward Muybridge out of England. He managed to get him over to California to set up an experiment. And the experiment was setting up 12 cameras along the track. And when the horse ran, it would trip a wire, so the cameras would, in succession, snap, 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 snap. And at the end of it, you were left with 12 photographs that when you put them on a board and you followed them from point A to the end, it gave you the illusion of motion. Muybridge put these images on silhouettes, on glass slides, and projected them on a little magic lantern. And that was really the first prototype motion picture. But the interesting thing is Muybridge had actually just murdered his wife's lover, blew his head off, and was arrested, and mysteriously he ended up, the charge was dropped. He literally got away with murder so he could fly to California and do this experiment. So movies were invented on murder itself.
Wow.
Now the first real horror, yeah, I know, it's a crazy story, but it's true. Now, the first real horror movie, it was actually by the French filmmaker Georges Méliès in, I believe, 1898. It was called House of the Devil. There was nothing scary about it at all, but it was the first bonafide horror movie.
The Karloffs, Lugosis, and Chaneys that we talked about in the earlier days, would they make it today?
You know, that's a really good question. I mean, it's hard to retroactively go throughout history and think if you could import something from the past, would it thrive today? Because everything that exists today was built on the shoulders of the past. But I know, as a student of history and someone who prefers to look back. You know, we're at this beautiful stage now with all pop culture, but all recorded pop culture, that no matter what we think we know, there's something we missed. So I'm constantly watching older films, constantly absorbing things that I missed. Now we're in this incredible world now where, 4K Blu-rays and streaming, we can see things that we'd only read about previously. But I do know that when you watch The Bride of Frankenstein, for instance, you can't imagine a better film than The Bride of Frankenstein. However, you know clearly if The Bride of Frankenstein was made today as is, it would be laughed off the screen. So guys like Karloff, Lugosi especially, I mean, can you imagine Bela Lugosi prancing around in the multiplexes today? Blah, blah, blah. It wouldn't work. But at its time, products of their time, and, you know, coming out of nowhere, because there was nobody like these titans of terror at the time, they were men of their time, and certainly they were, the founding fathers of fear, you know. And when you look at them through the historical lens today, I mean, yes, of course, you can appreciate the performance, and you can appreciate the grandeur that those men brought to the screen.
What would you say might be some of the scariest horror films of all time? Bar none.
This is so subjective, because what scares you in life is not going to scare me. I mean, for instance, I'm a father. When I had my children, I couldn't watch movies where children were put in any kind of jeopardy anymore.
I don't blame you.
Panic. Right, that was my panic button. So we all have our own different panic buttons or different stimuli that we cannot endure anymore in a fantasy context. That's over for us because it's too real. But that makes the movie that much scarier. But, I mean, I know for me that movies like Nicholas Roeg's Don't Look Now, which are, starring Donald Sutherland, there seems to be a theme here, still do me in. It was made in 1973. It's a mood piece. It's not high on action, but it's high on atmosphere and psychological subtext. And it still terrifies me to this day. George A. Romero's Dawn of the Dead killed me when I was 11 years old, and it still kills me today. That's my favorite horror film of all time because it's firing on every cylinder. It's got great characters. It's a great war film. It's a great gore fest. And it's got social satire and subtext. And it's truly, truly a scary motion picture. David Cronenberg, my countryman, came roaring out of the gates in 1975 with a scrappy little exploitation movie called Shivers about a sex parasite loose in a Montreal apartment building that still to this day, for all its cheapness and technical ineptitude, is still a terrifying motion picture. I could go on and on. I've tried, George, to list my top 10 scariest and favorite horror films. I end up at 100, and I've only scratched the surface.
Wow.
I kind of gave up. I gave up because I love them all. I love them all for different reasons.
Actor Bruce Campbell seems to be in a lot of these kinds of films. How's he doing these days? Do you know?
Bruce is a great guy and an interesting guy because Bruce is a brand in and of himself, and God bless him for that. But we talk about scary movies, and of course, I forgot to mention The Evil Dead, 1979.
Oh, yeah, huge.
A huge movie cost nothing. And here's a movie that, like the great horror films, the great independent horror films, they were scraped together by kids with a dream. And with nickels and dimes, and it wasn't about what spending exorbitant amounts of money. It was about ingenuity and imagination. And Evil Dead is simply the premise. If you've never seen it, well, then there's something wrong with you. But get out there and see it. A bunch of kids go to a cabin and open up a book and read some stuff from the book. And next thing you know, they're all hacking each other to pieces as they become, sequentially possessed by these demonic forces. So very low on plot, but again, high on style, high on atmosphere. And Bruce Campbell played the character of Ash. They spun that film into a trilogy of films and a television series, a remake, and I think there's another one in the works. But Campbell smartly, wisely capitalized on his fame in that film and has literally made a career in film and television and the convention, the horror convention circuit. Playing to his fan base. And, he's a great guy. He's definitely a one of a kind.
You talked about cost. Like, Bell Witch cost pennies and made a lot of money, right?
Well, the Blair Witch.
Blair Witch.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. It cost pennies, exactly. It was a bunch of guys' first-person film. I don't like the Blair Witch Project. I don't have to like the Blair Witch Project. It's not for me. For me, I like constructed fantasies. I don't necessarily like that wall being broken. That's an aesthetic choice. But you can't deny how powerful that film was to an audience. And I can't believe that film was even... I don't think a film like Blair Witch Project would be released today to theaters. I think that was the last gasp of the cheap horror film screens and being successful. I mean, that movie really ruined people because, the market, and that was mostly the marketing, man, because they really sold that it was actually an authentic experience, that someone had found this tape of these kids getting annihilated by some unseen force in the woods. And, most people with half a brain knew that was nonsense, but there was still a lot of people out there that were questioning what they were seeing, if it was real or not. And, that's how the Blair Witch rests exclusively on that conceit.
Chris, here's an actor we haven't brought up yet, and I thought he was a great horror actor, Vincent Price.
we should always talk about Vincent Price. We should always definitely talk about Vincent. And here's a guy that it seems to be, if you look at it, outside of the Karloffs and Lugosis, who found their fame in horror. You know, pretty much Karloff was a gigging actor with varying degrees of success, and he was in his late 40s by the time he became Frankenstein's monster. But, you know, a lot of these actors become horror stars. You either become horror star while you're climbing, you're on the way up, and then you get out of it, or as you're in your declining years, you latch onto it, and that becomes your thing. And Price was already, you know, a very established character actor before he became a quote-unquote horror star. That wasn't until the 1950s with a little 3D movie, which is actually the first studio 3D horror film, a 3D film period. That was House of Wax, which is, again, if you like 3D movies, it's still, to me, for my money, the best 3D film ever made. If you see that thing projected in 3D, it's unbelievable. But that was successful enough that Price became kind of a name, and then he followed that very quickly with The Fly. And then as we ooze into the 1960s, he started working with a guy named Roger Corman. And Corman was producing a series of films based on the works of Edgar Allan Poe. I'm actually writing a book about those films as we speak. And, yeah, Price became a household name when it came to horror. And he never looked back. It's something he carried literally to his last moments on this earth as he starred in Tim Burton's Edward Scissorhands back in, I think, 1988.
In 1959, he starred in the original House on Haunted Hill, which they've had several remakes. That I remember going to that movie with my dad as a kid, and it scared the living daylights out of me.
Let me ask you a question, because that was a film by the great gimmick master. We talk about this horror director as a sideshow carny, William Castle. And Castle's beat was he'd always throw some kind of gimmick in there. And when they the original release of House on Haunted Hill in select theaters, they billed it as being filmed in something called Emergio. And what would that meant is was during a scene where the skeleton was menacing a woman. A skeleton would actually fly down on a wire into the theater and scare the hell out of everybody. Do you remember the screening you saw? Was there a skeleton flying?
There was
around?
No. I don't remember the skeleton. I would have been out of there fast.
You got ripped off, George. I would have killed to have been alive in that period to experience some of those insane movies. And another one he made with Vincent Price was called The Tingler. And you remember that film, and what a great movie that is, even without the gimmick. But theater owners were instructed to wire every seventh seat, I believe, with some sort of mild electrical device, so that when the Tingler creature jumped on the spine, there's a sequence in the movie where Price starts yelling, "Scream for your life!" And then they'd be instructed to let this current go off, and people would actually get an electrical shock, and again, send them screaming for the exits. So those gory days of... the carnival horror film, I think, are sadly long gone.
We're going to take calls next hour with Chris Alexander about haunted horror films. Share yours or even ask him a question. What's the story of the situation in West Memphis, Arkansas?
Well, that's a whole thing in and of itself. But I think that's if anyone knows about the West Memphis Three, the three young men who were accused of murdering a bunch of little boys in West Memphis, Arkansas, about 25 years ago, in the early 90s. You know, that's a case of if you love this stuff, if you love horror movies, if you collect horror films, if you read Fangoria magazine and you listen to heavy metal and you fit the profile and you're in the wrong place in the wrong time, the consequences can be deadly. And in the case of that film, in the Bible Belt region of West Memphis, Arkansas, a guy named Damien Eccles, who was the ringleader of these kids, who just loved weird stuff, dressed in black, painted their fingernails black, were all arrested, tried, and convicted of murdering these kids when there was no real clear evidence.
Three children found dead, right?
Yeah. They were skinned, and they started to say it was a satanic ritual, and must have been these kids because they liked the weird stuff. And it's one of the great travesties of justice. It's well-documented in a series of films called Paradise Lost, three pictures. You get a chance, find those films and watch them. You know, Damien is out now. He's a friend of mine, but he spent 20 years, his entire burgeoning adult life, he was like 16, 17 when he was arrested, on death row, in most of it in isolation. And now he's liberated. And his story, post-release, is an amazing story, too. And if you get a chance, you can find some of his books. He's a very prolific author and speaker now. But he never let go of his love of horror movies. People used to have to smuggle Fangorias into the prison for him so he could catch up on the latest news.
Well, did they find the original killer?
You know what? They again, watch these films. If any of your listeners have not seen the Paradise Lost films, they're just toe-curling. unbelievable. Your jaw will drop. But they did find the killer, I believe, and it was one of the stepfathers of the children. But the issue was the case is so old at this point. The man is dead, so there's no way of prosecuting him. So sadly, none of this story ends well for anybody. Even the boys who are now out, I mean, they're a big chunk of their lives are gone. And none of this would have happened to them if they weren't horror movie fans, which I just find to be a very strange cautionary tale.
That's amazing. The Twilight Zone, classic. I love those shows. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, Twilight Zone, you know, again, those formative years, man, like talking about the Wax Museum, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you know, like Uncharted, all of that. I was raised in a family that you know, my relatives close and far liked movies, so I was always exposed to this stuff. And my father, like, probably leaned heavier into science fiction. And Twilight Zone offers the best of both because it's fantasy, science fiction, it's horror, it's morality tales. And I used to stay up late with him and watch reruns of The Zone. Never, obviously not in the first run. I wasn't even a glimmer in anyone's eye at that point. But back in the 70s when they were started to rerun, I would watch The Zone. And The Zone became a point of fascination for me. I don't have many tattoos, George. I'm not a tattoo guy.
Me either.
But I do have one tattoo on my arm that is the spiral from, I believe, season 4 of The Zone with the door itself in the middle of that. And that is my manifesto. That is it, loud and proud, saying that I am a Rod Serling disciple for life. I am obsessed with The Twilight Zone. It is my go-to. Anytime I'm feeling like I need some kind of reminder about great writing, because Serling to me is one of the great writers, great moralists of all time. He just happened to choose television as his vessel.
Exactly. We're going to take a quick break, Chris. We're going to come back and take calls with you next on Coast to Coast AM.